I'm happy now to welcome Lisa Dodson. She's a professor of sociology at Boston College and author of the new book, The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Now, this is a book about low-wage workers at every level of society. You're talking to people in industrial production and healthcare and retail, restaurant work, transportation, everything. And these people are not paid enough to live lives and take care of their families. How did you begin to do this study that resulted in the book?
Well, I've been, my work has been about low-income families for many, many years now. And the kind of research I do is I really try to go out and get the story of people who are living the experience. I don't only want to look at the numbers and the policies. I really want to hear the accounts from a lot of different people. So I have been involved in this kind of research for a long time, and particularly after welfare reform and when it became the job market for low-wage jobs, service jobs particularly, really grew, and a lot of those jobs were being filled by mothers. I really wanted to hear an account of how they were balancing their job, the obligations at work, and then also taking care of their kids. So I started many years ago, 2001 was when I started doing interviews with people around the country.
So 2001, it was after 9/11, and it was telling that somebody in your book said, you know, that everyone's talking about terror attacks. I have a terror attack every day when I go home and my child is in bed and has, you know, gotten herself ready. I mean, the folks you're talking about, 25% of all workers, I was shocked to learn in this book, are earning $9 an hour or less.
That's right. Yeah. There are somewhere around 30 million jobs right now that pay less than $10 an hour in this country. Yeah. So it is pervasive. It was really a reflection of an economy that moved away from production and much more to service kinds of jobs. And we did not keep the wage, the minimum wage, did not keep pace anywhere near with the costs of taking care of a family.
One of your discoveries was, and this is what's so interesting about this book and why it's called The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy, is that many employers, not to mention teachers and healthcare workers, all of whom you talk to, bend or break rules and even laws to help their workers survive. Talk about some of the examples of this.
Well, the examples of what I began to call economic disobedience. So it really reflects a history in our country, in America, of civil disobedience, but the place where this is taking place, playing out, is in the economy. So people who were engaging in these acts of economic disobedience were people who had whose jobs brought them every day into pretty close contact with working poor parents, or brought them into very close contact with low-income children through schools or daycare centers or through healthcare systems. And what would happen, particularly at the workplace, what people faced who were supervisors or managers in different kinds of companies in which people are employed at low wages, what would happen is that they would confront many different kinds of situations in which that low-wage parent would have problems performing exactly as they are supposed to. So they would be late to work a lot because they make such low wages that they can't afford a car, or they can't afford a car that runs very well. Or they would have to take sick days a lot, and sometimes their jobs didn't even, well, maybe gave them 3 sick days a year. Or they would have to leave because they didn't have childcare arrangements that were dependable. And these managers, in a sense, were faced with two ways of looking at this. One was blaming that person, blaming that parent. And that is often what we tend to do. We blame the low-income person. We blame the poor mother. The other way to look at it, though, and what I found, to my surprise, actually, was a lot of people said, I don't know how I would do any better. They would know the stories. They would know the situation. And they also knew the size of the paycheck that they gave people at the end of the week. And lot of these managers had their own families and made four or five times what they were paying, and they were having a hard time. So sometimes they would be in a situation where they found it just impossible, morally impossible, to punish somebody for being late or for having to leave because a child calls in or for having to miss another day because somebody's homesick. They found it morally unacceptable to go along with the rule, and so they started to bend the rules. And some people went pretty far in just breaking the rules because they did not want to be complicit with what they saw as just profoundly unfair.
And some of the people that you interviewed went as far as having two entire sets of timesheets, two entire sets of papers. One was the reality, so they could keep track of it, and the other was what they had to submit to the corporation.
That's right. That's right. I mean, what people in some cases, and this particular, I call her Cora in the book, she was a really wonderful example of someone who not only was unhappy with the rules, felt they were unfair, believed that the people working in that franchise were working very hard, were good people, thought that she should, if she could have, she would have paid them more. But one thing that she found she could do, and it was at risk of her own job, was she would allow them to make their own schedules, and that included, in many cases, people going in and out during the course of a day. In the end of the week, they worked the number of hours that they were paid for, but they worked them entirely against company policy. And there was no way she was going to argue for this with the corporate headquarters. So what she did was she simply created, as you say, two sets of timesheets and submitted one. And the other one she felt was morally responsible timesheet. It was one that reflected people's lives who have families, have small children, make very little money, and need to put their children first. And she agreed with that.
There was another example of a woman who was a vice president of a large corporation. I think it was healthcare. I mean, you have very scrupulously hid people's identities and the companies for a number of reasons, which we can talk about. But she had three employees, two of them African-American and one of them, I think, Haitian, Caribbean, who she got to know. And getting to know them changed her life drastically. Mm-hmm. And she ended up putting them in charge of doing something that she couldn't, namely scheduling all these low-wage workers.
Yeah, I mean, I loved her story because it was a long one. This had gone over time, so there were stages of what she felt ultimately was a process of becoming enlightened about how it is to live when you are making very little money. It was also, for her, being taught, learning lessons about race in America and about racism, as she put it. She, reflecting on her own attitude toward low income, most of these were single women working for her, raising children, she had some very stereotypic attitudes, which she then challenged as she got to know particularly those three women and recognized that they had just, they were carrying a world on their back and doing an incredible job. Loved their children very much, put their kids first, but also worked very hard. And so during a period at that hospital when she, when they began a push to hire low-income people from the community around it, which included a lot of African-American, Haitian, Latino family, people, workers from families, she wanted to do a good job. She wanted to make it possible to really incorporate community people at that workplace, very large workplace, and realized that she needed the expertise of people who understood far better than she. And so she really rewrote the rules of that large division, and she allowed them all kinds of latitude, decision-making, basically threw the rule book out the window, and they wrote their own. And in the process, in fact, had one of the most stable workforces, and also was one of the divisions that had incorporated a lot of very diverse people, diverse background, and did a really good job of it. But she had to do all this running parallel tracks, her sort of business VP track, outside of the office. And then when she went into her division, they had their whole set of rules, and they were humane rules. They were respectful of hardworking people and also very successful.
And one of the things about this example is that you wanted to share some of these new rules in the book, but you didn't. Tell us why not.
Well, you know, when you do this kind of research, you learn very quickly, and in fact, it is a basic rule of what's called human subject research, that you protect the identity of individuals. It's actually not all that hard to do, and all of the individual identities are protected in the book. But what I came upon when I would, after I would do a long interview and I would share the transcript, I'd share the result with the person who I'd gotten the information from, and we discuss it, and in numerous cases, what people said was that I can't let you use this information, and what she did was she said I could only use some of the information, because the strategies they were using to make it possible for low-income workers to do a little better, make a little bit of difference in their lives, the strategies they were using, once exposed, they could no longer use them. And those strategies and the help that they provide, the opportunity that they provided people, were seen as much more important than my being able to go into great detail in this book. And I completely respected that. I mean, that is the moral underground. It is putting people and being willing to bend rules, do things differently, go under the radar, some people called it, because it's more important that we treat people as though they matter than a rule book.
We're talking to Lisa Dodson, author of the new book, The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy. Now, there's a big secret hiding in plain sight, which is that slightly higher wages, flexible schedules, all the things that you're talking about, are actually good for business.
Mm-hmm.
Why do the corporate managers not realize this?
I think that even though there's ample information that if you have a more stable workforce and if you pay people better and provide them with benefits, you'll have a more stable workforce, that's absolutely many of corporate managers and corporate America just have not accepted that idea. And some have. There are some businesses that have done more of that. But that in general, there is the assumption that controlling people's schedules and minimizing pay and minimizing health care benefits, I mean, we see that's a national conversation, continues to be much more likely to the culture and the pattern of many businesses, not all. And I think also particularly over the past 10 years, there was a great deal of, as we know, of offshoring jobs altogether. Finding ways of reducing employment here in this country. And the idea of investing in workers, investing in American workers, investing in their future, and investing in their children, you know, providing stability means for that worker, you're providing stability for the next generation of our people. That has simply not been the business strategy that we see in this country.
There are a couple of terms that are used that I'd never heard before. Starving the beast, bleeding the beast. What do these words mean?
Well, starving the beast was used most often as a term for reducing any kind of public investment or social investment. So rather than, for example, increasing child care to make it available for people who are low wage, that there was a cutback. Big push to reduce government in all kinds of ways, and that was certainly part of welfare reform, and that reference has been often put out as starving the beast, you know, reducing social investment, reducing the role of government in supporting the development of people and supporting social programs for people, particularly our low-income people and our low-income children. So that's starving the beast. Bleeding the beast, I came upon that really with business, people in business who talked about getting as much as you possibly can out of, in some cases it was consumers, but in some cases it was also, it was the workers. It was basically getting as much as you can and investing as little as you can into the workforce.
Some of that ideology, that bleeding the beast, getting as much as you can and giving as little back, has been codified into the way business is taught. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. If you look at the discourse or the conversation about a business roundtable has looked at the changes over time about the idea of any kind of responsibility that business has, corporations have for the community, the larger community, the society. And over time, the shift has been increasingly, and particularly the last 10 years, the shift, last 20 years, but the last 10 particularly markedly, has been a shift toward the only obligation is to stockholders, the only obligation is to the people who have an economic interest in the company, and even then, a very small number of people. And this has been discussed in kind of business roundtable forum, and that change. I think that we see the evidence of that in terms of the shift of wealth. I mean, over the past 10, 15 years, the amount of wealth held by a very small group of people reflects precisely that. It is increased enormously over the past 10, 15 years, and whereas the people, the bottom third and the middle third, have in fact lost ground.
I was doing the math as I was reading this book, and I thought, okay, what if you tax the top 1% of Americans $1 million, and of course these are people who are untold billionaires.
Yes.
If you tax them each $1 million, that would be a $30,000 a year raise for 10 million American families.
That's a wonderful, I haven't done that, that's a wonderful piece of calculation there. I think that if we look right now at what, and it's happening right now, let's just look at what the bonuses turn out to be for the firms that of course did so very well in the bailout. Let's look at the bonuses that people have. I know that there's been some examination if we just took all of those bonuses and used those and spread those across the country, let's look at what kind of adjustment would go on there.
Another, I thought, piece of terminology that was telling was the term keeping clean. Keeping clean means not getting to know your employees.
That's right, yeah. That was a phrase that I heard first from somebody who I name B in the book, and she was explaining how one of the ways that managers are taught not to recognize what's going on in the lives of low-wage, entry-level, underpaid workers is to stay clean, and that meant don't learn, don't listen, don't, from my point of view, it began to sound like don't really recognize the humanity of their situation. Whatever you do, don't think about walking in their shoes. And that was a real difference between some of the people who, in fact, would express such concern, because that's precisely what they did. They imagined themselves in the situation. And once they did that, they found that it changed their behavior. So B talked about that she had been taught to keep it clean and that she did just the opposite. It was an interesting, sounds awfully clean to me to want to know what effect, you know, the job is having on your workforce. But
well, and the example of her life, this woman who you call B, is very sweet. She had an employee whose daughter was about to graduate from high school, and they didn't have nearly enough money to even buy her a prom dress.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, I think B was another person who, I mean, these people, I felt like, taught me a lot of lessons over the years of talking with them, just unexpected. If you think, in a sense, a very small moment, you know, a prom dress, but what B explained to me was that for her it was a real moral moment. Here was someone, Nancy, who had worked for quite a while, worked very hard, as B said, and had a daughter who she called Edie, And Edie was had also worked very hard to graduate from high school. And this was a real moment of celebration in that family. And they simply could not afford to buy this child a prom dress to go to the prom. And for Bea, this was profoundly wrong. She thought that that moment should be of joy, of celebration for a hardworking family. It was completely wrong that they should not have that. And so what Bea did was she manipulated her position as someone in a very large big box store that had a lot of prom dresses in it. And as she put it to me, prom dresses get brought in, some of them get laid away, some of them get returned, and there's a lot of motion and movement, and one of them could slip through the cracks fairly easily. And so I asked her how Edie looked on prom night, and she said, well, she knocked them dead.
All these stories you tell really point to conflicts of obligation. So there's this obligation to the company that managers are really trained very hard to feel. And there's an obligation in that example of the woman working in the big box store. They are trained as corporate managers to feel that they are serving the public, which what that means is something to talk about. And then, of course, there's this obligation of the employees to the employees that they're not really trained to experience at all. And all of these things are at odds with each other.
That's right. That's how it's presented in a lot of business, in the business culture, that your obligation, first and foremost, is to the stockholder, is to make money. And secondly, it seems, to the public. And not even on the list is the worker, the people who you, in fact, can spend day in and day out getting to know. And what this was extremely troubling for a lot of people. Not everybody were willing to bend rules or to make something like a prom dress available to a young person who was graduating from high school. But it was troubling to most people who I talked to. And most of them, what they wanted, most of the managers with whom I spoke, what they wanted is they wanted to work well in their job, they wanted to do well for their business, but they wanted that to not be against. They did not want a conflict between that and the people who worked for them. They wanted to do both, and they considered both to be part of their responsibility. It was part of an ethic that they brought with them. And it to be put in this position where it's a dilemma to treat people who work for you decently, to try to be fair, which is the word that came up all the time. It just doesn't seem fair. You know, I want to be a fair person. For that to serve the company and to feel as though you're being unfair to these hardworking people who you've gotten to know very well, this was a real dilemma for a lot of people. And my sense is, after doing years of this research, this runs throughout these companies and throughout society.
And all of the people who made decisions in favor of the employees and who bent and broke the rules, all of them, if found out, could have or still could lose their jobs and their careers even.
Absolutely. No, it was a risk. I mean, it was varying risks depending on the acts that they decided to take. But in some cases, there was absolutely no question that they would have lost their jobs,
We're talking to Lisa Dodson, author of the book, The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy. Another part of this discussion is that it's something that's almost completely lost, I think, from the national discussion today, but that the money that low-wage workers are not earning is creating wealth for others. In other words, they are basically making us one class of people live in total poverty while another class gets rich off their work. I mean, this is classic socialist Marxist analysis, but it's true to this day.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I mean, if we look at how much wealth has been made in this country, how much wealth these companies are making every year, and it has increased in certain areas just dramatically, and at the same time, keeping minimum wage as low as we have, and basically creating poverty for working people. Poverty in America is about wages. It's not unemployment. The vast majority of poverty in America is based on wages. That this is a shift of the wealth, which was always stratified, but it was an increase in the shifting of the wealth up. A lot of people have, over the past 15 years, become astonishingly wealthy. And at that same time, for example, child poverty in America has just increased dramatically. There's somewhere around 30 million children in America who are below the poverty line now, and about 45 million who are in low-income families. And recently, some data came out that over the course of childhood in America, half of all children will be on food stamps at one time or another. Well, the only way you can get food stamps is if your parents are making a very low income and you have virtually no assets. So this is a comment on how wealth and compensation for work, how wages are distributed. And what I found is that it was very disturbing to lots of different people. And these people were diverse. They were not all liberals, or they were not all from one part of the country or another part of the country. These were white and black and Latino people of different backgrounds and religions. But in general, what they really shared was the sense that if people are doing the jobs of the country, they're working hard, they're trying to raise their families, they should make a living. They should be able to take care of their own. And in the current situation where some people are making enormous wealth while millions and millions of families are struggling, millions and millions of hardworking families, then that is really wrong and it should be changed.
It's also, I think, important to point out that a lot of these $9 an hour or less jobs do not have a career ladder. So there's a kind of emptiness in the managers who say, well, they should just work harder so they can advance. There is no advancement for a lot of these folks.
That's right. That was a question that I often asked employers. I asked them that if these low-wage workers who worked for them, if they were to do everything right, if they were never to take a sick day or never take more than the 3 a year they're given, if they were to work very hard, what was the advancement possibility for them? Could they get away from a poverty wage? And in most cases, of only one area, healthcare, was there a little difference there. But for the vast majority of jobs, what the manager said was, no, there is these jobs top out at a low wage, and only if they went back to school, post-secondary education, was it going to be possible for them to do better than that. So, these are jobs without a future and very often with very limited, if any, benefits.
It's really shocking to find out that a lot of people working in the healthcare field, taking care of the elderly and working in hospitals, don't have health insurance.
That's right. That's health insurance for a family is about equivalent to some of these minimum wage jobs, that alone. And it is one of the ways that health care costs, particularly in nursing homes and in other kinds of health facilities, one of the ways that they keep the costs down, is keeping labor costs down, is by not giving people health insurance. So you have, and I have interviewed many people working in nursing homes and in community health settings in which they're either there's no option for health insurance or the copayment that the person has to pay for a family is so high that it represents 25% of the money that they're making, their earnings, and they simply can't give that up.
The book that you wrote points to a lot of structural failures in the larger society, not just the greed and stinginess of corporations, which is certainly there too, but also the lack of functional public transportation that get people from point A to point B, the non-availability of low-cost or free childcare for people and after-school programs, and the lack of affordable health insurance. Those three things, if they were truly deeply solved, would change a lot of these stories radically.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there are three ways that people can make a living. One is that they work hard. That's their contribution, that they're responsible and they work hard, they do their job. The other is that they are paid a wage that, for that work, it covers all of those basic human needs. It covers child care. People can't leave their kids all alone. It covers health care. It covers all your basic costs. And then the other way is that we invest in our people. We invest in social programs that ensure that people who are working but are earning wages that are not enough to cover all the basic human needs, then we invest in our people. And so we provide that. We provide public child care because many, many families cannot purchase it on the market. It's too expensive. And, of course, it's some combination of those three that ultimately work. And in many other countries, that's precisely what they do. Countries which do provide child care do provide health care. And they provide it not because they think they're giving gifts. They provide it because they want to invest in their people and in their future generation. They recognize that this is a way to keep a society strong. And so those really are the options. But that's where those phrases, starve the beast and bleed the beast, we've starved the social programs in this country increasingly over the past 20 years. We never provided child care for all of our people, and now the amount available, it covers about one in every eight children in this country. So most of them do not have access to subsidized child care or free child care, and we have not insisted that working parents be paid a wage where they can buy it themselves, which, you know, many of them will be very happy to do. So those are our choices, and right now what we've done is we've just focused on the individual. And it reflects this kind of almost cult of individual responsibility. It's so much a part of the policy discussion over the past 10 years. And individuals do have responsibility, but I have to tell you that a lot of the people I interviewed, working people, they're very responsible. And what's more, their bosses even said that to me. Most of the employers said to me they thought that most, not all, but most of the people who worked for them worked very hard. But we have there is the expectation of a work ethic, but we have not lived up to a wage ethic. We do not insist upon an ethical wage for our people, and we don't make up for it with programs that would ensure that their children and families are safe and cared for.
You spoke, and the second part of your book is about this, to a lot of teachers. And teachers, many of them, are put in the position of being not only teachers, but also social workers, therapists, and substitute parents.
Yes. Yeah, a whole nother advantage on the impact of having 30% to 40% of our families not making a sustainable income, a whole other place that you really see it is where their children enter the public space, where they go to child care centers or where they go to schools. And I spend a lot of time talking with teachers and principals in schools, and the dilemma that they face is that they're trained to teach. Their expectation, and it's a mainstream expectation, is that children come to school in the morning and they're ready to learn, and they come to school from having had a decent night's sleep and food and some sense of stability, some schedule, and they're ready to learn. And the problem is that if you don't make enough money to provide your children with that, you don't make enough money to provide them with stable housing or adequate food, or if you can't even be home in the morning because a lot of these jobs insist that you be out the door at 6 and your kids don't leave till 7:30, these children come to school from family situations that are very insecure, and it shows. They bring that insecurity and harm with them when they go into the schools. And so the teachers are confronted with a situation where they can pretend that it's all the children's fault, or more likely their mother's fault, their parents' fault, that these kids aren't in a condition or able to perform in a mainstream way. Or, as a lot of teachers do, they can look at the situation and they can say, this child just can't meet these norms. The situation they come from is just too fragile. And so many of them will really extend themselves. But I found I found that even those that would do this, that they would try to help the child, they would give special attention to different children. I also found that they were often at a loss themselves. A phrase I often heard was, I just don't know what my job is anymore. They had a great devotion to doing well by their children, not all teachers by any means, but many of them really do. And yet they're confronted with a situation, and these children they're really not ready. Some of them, of course, are, but there's always, and teachers tell me increasing number, are just not ready to learn because their circumstances are just too insecure. And this is because of the economic circumstance of the family.
Well, there's one example of, there were several like that in your book, but there's one that I really remember of a woman who was a healthcare worker in a nursing home. And when she got done with her first eight-hour shift, she went to another nursing home and worked another eight-hour shift. And her little five-year-old son stayed up late at night waiting for his mom to come home so he could tell her about his school day.
Yeah.
And she would fall asleep while he was talking.
Yeah. Yeah. I interviewed a number of people mothers who work two shifts, because if you're paid $8 an hour for your work, you will have to work many more hours, and the way they arranged that was they worked two shifts, and then there's also time in between the two different places where they worked, and one mother, she spent 5 hours a day at night at home between the two shifts that she worked. So she would come home from her job, and she would be absolutely at her jobs. She would come home from her jobs, and she would be absolutely exhausted. And she'd very much want, and she'd know her child, her little boy, desperately wanted to see her. Kids want to see their moms and their dads at the end of the day. They want to tell what's going on, the troubles they had, and also the successes they had. They want to share that more than with anyone else. They want to share it with their parents. And she understood that, and she very much wanted to be able to listen to him talk about what has gone on in his life. But she was literally come home from a 20-hour day, and she'd crawl into bed and hold him and fall asleep. And she also was aware of the fact that he'd be staying up very late just to have a chance to actually see her. And this is a egregious situation for any family to have to face.
We're talking to Lisa Dodson, author of the book The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy. There's the last part of your book is about healthcare providers who are the most likely of the three groups, managers, teachers, and healthcare providers, who you all talk to really break the rules, because for them the alternative is throwing sick people out onto the street.
Yes, that's right. I found that healthcare providers, nurses, doctors, nurse practitioners, and people working in community health centers, there were two ways in which I think that they had a particularly immediate insight and were the most likely to break the rules. One of those was that is an area where the problem of healthcare is an area which is really spread throughout society. And so a lot of middle-class people who don't face the same kind of crises with childcare, they do have childcare, they pay very dearly for it, but they do have it, however, have found themselves in situations where healthcare has become an issue that has, in some cases, people have lost their savings, or in some cases, people can't leave their job and take another one. And so there's a sense about the injustice of health care that has really spread beyond lower-income and working-class people. So I think that was one element that made health care providers in general already feel as though they were that they sometimes had to take stands that were against the rules. But the other issue is that fundamentally, as a health care provider, what you're taught is to do no harm. In fact, to do good. I mean, that is the essential commitment of a healthcare provider. And you have a situation in which you can sit there and explain to this mom what she should do to make sure her child doesn't have asthma attacks. And asthma there's a high proportion of children in low-income communities who have asthma. So you can explain to her the way she needs to change the child's conditions in her apartment, get rid of the dust, keep the child from certain kinds of stresses. There's a whole list of ways in which you can help ameliorate asthma. And I talked to a physician who said to me, you know, I felt like a fool saying this. I knew her situation. She was juggling two jobs, and she was barely holding it together to keep her child fed. And so these are situations where if you have a way to hand over that asthma medication that's even perhaps she's not eligible for it, or you want to give her more than she is so that she can give it to her other child that is not yet on the books as getting this medication. In other words, if there are ways that you can manipulate your position as a physician or a nurse practitioner, I found the most... This was an area where there was a lot of readiness to do it. They really took the stand, and I think felt the most confidence in taking the stand that the patient, the person, comes first.
One of the things that I was thinking about a lot while reading your book is that the stories of these people are so unrepresented or underrepresented in the media, in the news, in... perhaps a little bit more in literature, I'm not really sure, but not in the movies, not in TV. Mm-hmm. And if they were, maybe a lot more people would understand.
Yeah, I mean, one of the commitments I made as I started to do the research for this book was to do everything I could to shine a light on what is really the ordinary situation of many, many millions of our people and our families. It does not find voice in mainstream media for the most part, and it certainly is not well represented in big policy debates about the economy. I mean, we have heard more and more about corporations and banks and bailouts and CEO pay, and there is more information about the growing number of people in poverty in America. But those are really the extremes. In the middle is where most of us live, and in the middle there's a lot of experience with what is going on in such an unfair economy, such stratification. There's a lot of experience and knowledge. There's also a lot of moral strength and, to me, a lot of courage that people took, you know, to take a position to support other people and not be complicit with rules that were really unjust. So my commitment in doing this book really was a commitment to try to shine a light on this, try to illuminate who we really are as a people. I feel that this reflects our best American history, a willingness of people to take a look at the rules and to decide, no, they're unjust, and I'm not necessarily going to go along with them.
It does really shine a light, I think, on both forces in American history. On the one side, you have the legacy from slavery and Jim Crow and child labor in the mills of New England and all this kind of stuff on the one side. And on the other side, you've got the Underground Railroad, you've got union movements, you've got every kind of economic justice movement. And they've been at war with each other for centuries.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I guess for me, one of the voices that came out of this was I recognized a familiar voice from American history, and that is that ordinary people are really the answer. You know, it's when they begin to recognize that the inequality, that the economic, in this case, economic injustice, is affecting the whole society. They see it right in front of them. They see people every day who they have gotten to know and recognize as, in a sense, part of their society, that they're actually willing to take a stand. And that is the best history we have. We have a history, the only time there was really big change where we moved away from really deep injustices in this country was when the recognition was spread among, you know, common people, the rest, all of us. And we began to say, no, I want to count myself over here. I want to be part of the people who make it a more just society. I feel as though maybe I'm making enough to live, but every single day I'm looking into the faces of people who are working just as hard as I am, and they're not making enough to live. And that's not the kind of society I want to live in. And so my part of my goal for this book was to let people know that they're not alone. There are lots of people out there from different vantages, you know, in healthcare, teachers, and in business, in jobs all over, small but place businesses and large, that really share the idea that that there should be more fairness.
As I was reading the book, I was thinking about some other books I've read in the past about Holocaust rescuers and people who put, obviously the stakes are much higher, but put their lives and everything on the line to help people just because it was the right thing to do. And just like the people that you talk about in the book, their commonality was non-existent. There was no commonality among age, income, race, religion. They just did these things because it was the right thing to do. In their case, there was really no political movement that they could join because they knew they'd be killed. In our case, here, where we're not going to be sent to camps necessarily if we have a real political movement, we still don't have a real political movement. What's going on?
Well, I think that that is, just a critical issue, and I think it is what is most needed. What I found was that there were lots and lots of individuals and who were willing to take stands, first of all, who disagreed with how unfair the economy is, and then there were some who were willing to engage in acts of disobedience, but they didn't know that there were others like them, and they would often reach deep inside themselves for justification for their acts. They would say, it's because, well, I come from an immigrant family, and I know what it's like, and so, you know, I have a special feeling for other people working this hard. Or they say, I come from an African-American family, and we have a history of knowing that sometimes the law is wrong. Or people would say, well, I've been a single mother, or I was raised in a single mother family, and I know how hard it is. So I found it really interesting. People would seek within themselves, within their identities, a kind of moral justification for doing what ultimately lots and lots of different people were doing. They shared the same moral stand and perspective. A movement? No, I did not come upon a particular movement, but there were periods in history before there were movements when I think that's precisely what was happening, where individuals looked at what was going on and decided that in their own little way, often in secret, they would do the best they could and take the side of people who were being unjustly treated. And I see that as what's going on right now. We'll see if there's going to be a movement. We'll see if there's a way to join all these people together.
Lisa Dodson is professor of sociology at Boston College and author of the new book, The Moral Underground, How Ordinary Americans Subvert an Unfair Economy. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you.